Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. Well, lots of little black books. Here on my right is the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files, and I've reached down to get one that's been down a few times previously. Over the past couple of episodes, we've looked back at RuneQuest and Call of Cthulhu, and some of the staples from what we used to play back in the day. And this time, we're looking at Traveller. This year marks 50 years since the release of Dungeons & Dragons. So for this episode, we have a very special guest. Someone who was right there at the beginning and who was inspired, along with Frank Chadwick, to do something different with this concept. He wrote and discovered and released a made Traveller RPG. Mark, join me in the Zoom of role-playing rambling to talk about how Traveller came about and some of his thoughts about the game and where it sits in the history of role-playing games. Me and the resident rules lawyer, Blythe, head to the attic where we revisit Judge Blythe's rules. We've been playing this game on a regular basis over the past couple of years, so it seems appropriate that we revisit what we think about it and some of the highlights of the new rules that have been released by Mongoose. It's 50 years since the dawn of RPGs, and it's also another significant anniversary because it's 40 years since we left school. And this has inspired our closing time chatter at the end of the podcast. And I'll come back just at the very end to do a few parish notices. But until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open box.
Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling. This time we have a very special guest, one of the founders of this thing of ours, the creator of Traveller, the best-selling science fiction role-playing game of all time. Welcome to Mark Miller. Hello there, Mark.
Well, thank you for asking me to be with you, and thank you for that compliment on Traveller.
We're still playing. We've got a campaign on the go at the moment. We're playing the Pirates of Drinnix and having a great time.
Mongoose is doing a great job with Traveller. I really like what they're doing.
And do you still have oversight over the things that they produce?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
We're a good partnership. It works very well.
It's the 50th anniversary of the release of Dungeons & Dragons. Can you remember the time when you first encountered Dungeons & Dragons?
We were board war gamers. Some people don't remember now, but of the SPI and the Avalon Hill sort of thing, boards and little counters and hex grids. We really enjoyed our time. We enjoyed playing war games, Panzerblitz or Europa, all those wonderful board games. And we had people all across the country who enjoyed playing them as well. And sometimes they would stop by and visit us in our offices in middle of downstate Illinois. On this particular occasion, some war game friends came from Michigan. They said, you know, there's this Dungeons and Dragons thing. Of course, we had no idea what that meant. So he showed us. We were all immediately hooked. I mean, we're already game designers. That's what we did all day long. We understood games. You can put a game in front of us and we would understand it far faster than most people would. And we immediately saw the opportunities that Dungeons and Dragons provided. First of all, we called up one of our distributors and said, we want 5 copies of Dungeons and Dragons. And they say, it's out of stock. We don't have it. So then we grabbed the copy that this fellow had. Downstairs below us is a drugstore, and next to it's a copy shop. We immediately made copies of all the books. Now, we're aware of the legitimacy or illegitimacy of making copies of somebody's product, but we had ordered them. We knew they were coming. We were going to pay for what we were buying. Working at Game Designers Workshop was an interesting experience because two kinds of people working there. There are the administrative people who handled the orders and handled the bookkeeping and the administration and all sort of things like that. And the creatives, and the admins came in at 8:30 in the morning and left at 4:30 in the afternoon. The creatives would come in at all hours and leave at all hours. And there was some tension because the administratives, why do they get come in at 11 o'clock in the morning? Well, because they stayed until 11 o'clock at night. That's why. Frank Chadwick was our company president. And occasionally he would make a statement. And this time he said, you can't play Dungeons and Dragons while the sun's up. We were getting no work done over the next several weeks after we discovered Dungeons and Dragons. We were getting no work done at all. People would come in at 11 and start playing with the other people and playing their Dungeons and Dragons campaign. And if they weren't playing it, they were building maps and they were doing whatever they wanted to do with their Dungeons and Dragons. And so we weren't getting any work done. You know, we still played just as much Dungeons and Dragons under the new rule as the old rule. It's just that we did have the opportunity to get our work done as well. Clearly, Dungeons and Dragons is a miniatures game, a miniatures-oriented game. Gary Gygax is a miniatures-oriented guy. He did chainmail. He knew what miniatures were. And it shows in the rules for Dungeons and Dragons. We, on the other hand, were board gamers with hex grids. We hauled out a 22 by 28 inch hex grid to draw our continents on because we were used to board game aspect of the game of it. And so we had huge maps of continents that we wanted to play. And that's part of what we did is spent a lot of time coloring them in with markers and whatever else we needed to do. It was a wonderful time. Yeah. Nobody had done this before. It was, I like to say that role playing is something that a psychiatrist says, act as if you're your mother or act as if you're your boss and tell me how you think. And it's for insights, but it's all analog. We can't really tell how accurate your role playing of that senator or that brother or that adversary is because it's all filtered through your own perceptions. And Gary said, this guy has a strength of 7 or 10. He has an intelligence of 8. Clearly he's smarter than someone with an intelligence of 6. And those are easy concepts to get. Of course, America was just moving from analog to digital in the 70s. And so it was influencing the rest of our lives as well. But Gary digitized role-playing. He made it processable objectively instead of subjectively. We can still be subjective on the character we play and the 7-page backstory of my wood elf raised by humans or whatever I want to talk about.
Didn't you have some experience of role-playing in effect for strategic purposes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, any game, any of the historical games is a role-playing game. I'm Napoleon. These are the rules on how I try and fight the Battle of Waterloo. I'm Wellington. This is what I'm trying to do. Often playing the games is more focused on winning than it was on role playing. I'm just wandering here as we talk, but this is fun. I appreciate you asking me to talk about this. There was a crisis in board gaming at the time, 50 years ago. So we grognards know what we're doing, what was happening. But a lot of the newer generation don't. There was a glorification of the German military machine. There were swastikas printed on counters in games that we played. The Nazi colors were used. Panzerblitz was it's a wonderful game. It's a wonderful simulation. It's a wonderful war game. But it also appealed to more than just the historical war gamers. It appealed to kids who were impressionable. And as a result, we saw a glorification of Nazis. You know, Panzerblitz was a bestseller, not for weeks or months, but for years. Kids would sit down and play with it, and they would say they really liked the German military equipment. They liked the Panzer IV or the Tiger or whatever it was that they had. They enjoyed those things. And somewhere in there, seeping into it was glorification of Nazism at the same time. There were game clubs where kids, where members wore uniforms to go to play games at game meetings. It was a problem. It was a problem. And if it had continued, I think wargaming would have been, would have died. It would have been hard to keep that hobby going with a strong glorification of militarism, offensive militarism. The gaming community was not glorifying the winning of wars by American capitalism. It was fighting battles of Germans against Russians. The Germans were clearly better. You had to make somebody play the Russian because the German, everybody wanted to play the German. And I'm going somewhere with this because it's against that background that Dungeons and Dragons appeared. Wargaming, board gaming, role playing is an adult enterprise today. I mean, kids play it. We thought our market was high school kids then, but it was adults. You know, it's young adults, it's old adults, it's old men, it's fewer women than there are in the hobby today. When Dungeons and Dragons appeared, it gave many of these players the ability to play those aberrant, abhorrent fantasies. I use both words. Abhorrent because I abhor them, those fantasies, because they're about militarism and whatever. And aberrant because they were off the main focus. They were glorifying Nazism. Those players got the opportunity to play an evil lord, a Darth Vader in role-playing. Darth Vader in science fiction, evil lord in Dungeons and Dragons. They could do whatever they wanted. But it's not socially unacceptable to be an evil lord. It is socially unacceptable to be a Nazi general. Dungeons and Dragons took off immediately. It resonated with players. And many of them had been playing the war games and finding some satisfaction in doing that. And they got much more satisfaction being the evil lord or the neutral lord. Everybody wants to be neutral. That way you have no, in some ways, neutral is worse than evil because it just says you can do anything. You can be good. You can not be good. Nobody holds you to any standard of behavior at all. But I think role playing saved this hobby. Now I'll say another thing that, you know, we were playing these games. We enjoyed playing them, but we had no idea that it was a larger enterprise than what we were doing. It was us playing. Here we are 50 years later, and we're playing with our children or our grandchildren. We are seeing families that go to Gen Con, and it's not just the dad wants to go because he wants to see it. Everybody wants to go. The mother thinks it's a wholesome enterprise. The kids want to do what dad plays, as well as finding their own things to play. Gen Con's the biggest convention in Indianapolis throughout the whole year. Who would have imagined? You would think the sales convention for some insurance company would be the biggest convention. But no, it's Gen Con. It's role-playing. It's this hobby that is good, clean, fun. Despite all the scandals about how this is devil worship or whatever else it was, we all know, and the public now knows, it's just good, clean fun.
And you've mentioned a few times, Mark, the idea of community. And I suppose at that time and where you are, it's almost like the Silicon Valley of role playing. Was there a sense that it was a community? And what interaction did you have with the different companies and the different players in the scene?
That's an interesting question. I like that question because you hit on what still is going on in gaming, but it was really going on in the 70s and the 80s. We knew each other. I mean, my company, the people at Game Designers Workshop, knew the other companies, who they were. We would talk to them on the phone. We would go to conventions. We would know each other. We would have a good time talking. Early on in Game Designers Workshop's history, we piled into our car in Illinois and drove the 800 miles to New York City because SPI, Simulations Publications, Inc., the big war game publisher, bigger than Avalon Hill. They were putting out war game designs, you know, monthly in their subscription magazine. They had a game night. They mentioned it in their magazine. We came in. It said it was going to be March 28th, whatever it was. And so we piled into our car, my car, and drove to New York City. Those were lean days. We did not stay at a motel on the way. We just drove through straight. You know, we stopped at some campground just to shower before we got into New York City. We parked on the street and walked up and introduced ourselves. And you can't imagine the reception we got, which is positive. I mean, they welcomed us. They said, oh, we know who you are. You know, they conveyed that they knew who we were. They welcomed us in. They showed us around their offices. They showed us the designs they were working on. We sat in on a business meeting. It was really an education on how they did business. And that's pretty much how game companies treated each other. There was no, can't tell them our secrets. There was, here, this is how we do things. This is what's going on. What are you working on? We're working on this. SPI had a system that readers would send in a postcard with their thoughts on a scale. You know, we're proposing these games. Would you like to see them? And you rate it 1 to 10. I really followed that with great interest. I enjoyed it. I went down and I sat next to the person running the computer. This is a kind of a, this is pre-personal computer time, early 70s. And he's keying in these responses at his keyboard. I was enthusiastic. Here I am, probably 25 years old. I wonder what this is going to be. And he said, we key these in, but I can tell you what the answer is going to be the first day, that most of the results will cluster around some number or some value. I can know which ones are winners. I can know which ones are losers from the beginning of the input. I mean, that was a revelation to me. I thought every vote counted. And I wasn't thinking of the aggregate that most of the people out there were thinking the same way. Great insights that I got just because they shared them with us. Avalon Hill and SPI decided they were going to do a convention. They had the first Origins Game Convention in Baltimore. There we got to meet all these people at the same time. You know, we all had booths and we enjoyed talking to people, and everybody wanted to talk to everybody else. It was hard to stop anybody talking. We were kind of a middle boy. There were the little boys, the small companies, and the big boys like Avalon Hill and SPI. And we're not even getting into role-playing at this point. I'm just talking about board games, historical war games. Some of the SPI staff really latched onto the fact that a lot of these games are hex-grid war games. And they said, you're copying us. You know, there's a copyright thing of the hex grids. And they ran to tell Jim Dunnigan, who is the president and one of the geniuses that ran SPI. And he said, don't bother them. We're not going to make anything out of keeping other people from making games. Mm-hmm. And hex grid games are interesting things that people love. Don't give them a hard time. To the extent that I can tell you, they can use the hex grids any way they want. Talk about the self-confidence of this genius game designer, that it was not just games, but business, that he understood that this industry could be friendly or it could be angry. And he chose friendly. Always mm-hmm. struck with me. Still that way today. I mean, if you go to a game convention, when I go as a manufacturer, as a publisher, the people don't look strange at each other. They talk to each other. They say, how do you do this? What do you do? How are you doing? What's business? How's it going? We just talk business all the time. And usually it's, can I have a copy of your new game? You know, because we exchange feathers. Yeah, but I want a copy of your new game. And so we would exchange them. That would go well. That was fun.
I've seen early editions of White Dwarf where you came over to the UK to Games Day. Yes. What was that experience like?
That was another incredible experience. Games Workshop invited me over, you know, and I thought this would be fun. We would do that. That would be fun. I remember packing a suitcase full of the little black books for Traveler, sneaking them through customs. I was actually afraid to do something. I went through the red door instead of the green door and said, I've got a bunch of books. They said, oh, they're books. Nobody cares. Go on through. And they were games, they were titles that hadn't yet made it to the UK. And so everybody was really happy for me to have those to sell them off at less than they sold normally anywhere. It was really a lot of fun. I remember giving one of my seminars. We had talked about Traveler that had never been written down or didn't know how to, we hadn't yet done it. It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. At that time, that was 1981. In September of 1981, the first digital watches had just been made. I remember that I was standing up there, and in a perfect example of a bell curve, someone's watch beeped at the hour, and then another one beeped, and then a bunch of them beeped right on the hour, and then a couple of them beeped again. But it just struck me that here we had a golden sample, which virtually everybody had a digital watch to the same, but not enough. So the bell curve of on the hour beeps. I enjoyed that. I still remember that.
Ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
Let's talk about Traveller. I suppose the first question is, why science fiction? Why did you choose that as the genre?
Well, you know, we played Dungeons and Dragons. We enjoyed that. But doing a fantasy role-playing game, we'd be stepping on that product. I mean, can we do fantasy better than D&D? Maybe we could. Maybe we should. Who knows? We had a guy who, kind of a high school kid, who kept hanging around the office. We had a lot of that at GDW, you know. Some high school kid discovered our place and would show up. And he was, Daryl Haney was his name. He was taking fencing lessons. And so he had a couple of foils. And he showed us the basic moves of thrust and parry, and that intrigued Frank Chadwick. And together they, Daryl and Frank, put together a sequence of moves to play out fencing. And immediately Frank wanted to make that into a larger thing. And he immediately thought of the Three Musketeers, and he designed En Garde, which was a little 48-page, 6x9 booklet, where you created a character with D&D-like characteristics, and then you interacted with those other characters that other people had, looking for excuses to have a duel. We have a rule for sword fights. We have to have reasons for having duels. So our first role-playing game was a Three Musketeers sort of game. You know, Gary Gygax saw it and really liked it because it wasn't a blatant copy of D&D. It took role-playing to a new level, to a different level. The secret of En Garde was that this group of players for tonight would all roll up characters. And sure, we had reasons to do sword fights, but nobody wants to sword fight because you can get hurt. So, but one character would clearly would have the highest social level, the prince or the duke or whatever it was. And you could get points and benefits by sucking up to him. So everybody would, you know, want to buy him a drink or make sure that they defended his honor when somebody insulted him or whatever it was. But there were, the mechanism gave you benefits if you did things that sucked up to this high social character, who was not necessarily the high social character in our player group. So we got to take some kid who just showed up, and he's the one they're all going to suck up to and make nice to. And he really enjoys that. You know, Frank Chadwick ended up being kind of a low man on the totem pole. He, oh, please, sir, could I? And whatever. And really role played that out. He had a good time. Everybody enjoyed that. And the other secret of En Garde was it wasn't a campaign. At the end of the night, those characters are gone. We're going to roll up new characters the next time we play En Garde. And so somebody else gets to be top dog. Somebody else gets to play the low man on the totem pole. It was a wonderful, enjoyable exercise in designing a role-playing game and seeing how it works and experimenting with everything that was involved. That was our first role-playing game. You know, Game Designers Workshop had this process where we would have a business meeting every week, and we would talk about the progress we're doing on the designs we're making, on where we're going with things, what we're coming up with, what we want to do. I was doing a game. I was doing Imperium, an interstellar space war game. I was doing Raphia, a game of set in what's now the Gaza Strip, 200 years BC. I was doing many different games on many different subjects. And I said, nobody's doing science fiction role-playing. I want to do science fiction role-playing. And as typical at GDW, people didn't laugh. They said, go ahead. Remember, I'm a creative at the company. I would come in at 11 o'clock in the morning. I would stay till 11 or 12 or 1 at night, partly because I had access to the machines, whatever word processors we needed. And I had that access uninterrupted. So I could work well into the night doing what I wanted to. That was an unusually creative time in my life. Through that period of 1976, I was designing Traveler. And I'll confess, I started out with the three books from D&D off to the side. And I said, where do I start? Well, the first book's about characters. My first book will be about characters. But it wasn't Dungeons and Dragons. I felt that multi-sided dice were hard to get a hold of. Six-sided dice are easier to understand. I thought it helped us understand the probabilities better. So I created a rudimentary game system. But, you know, we have in science fiction, I have a different model than we do in fantasy. That we have Star Trek. Didn't yet have Star Wars, but we had Star Trek. We had science fiction movies. We had Forbidden Planet. We had all of the science fiction novels. We had Andre Norton's Solar Queen with Free Traders. I'm trying to put together what I thought science fiction characters would be. And I wanted something like GURPS. I wanted a science fiction system that would handle anything.
It's a toolkit, isn't it?
Once I decided we had a navy, then we have to have a government. We have to have not just a government, we have to have a rival government. And empires is what we think of in space rather than democracies. I was a voracious science fiction reader, had read most of science fiction coming up to the 70s. I had read the magazines. I had read, I would buy a paperback novel every day and read it, put it aside. I just knew everything. And I wanted all that. But slowly this story evolved. Dungeons and Dragons did not have an empire. Dungeons and Dragons, as it started, just was some place. You're some kid, and you set about going out, and there's nothing. We don't know what's out there. It's Middle Ages without any structure. You might have a duke somewhere, but there's no hint that there's an emperor. I needed to provide some structure. And so we are wargaming-oriented. We wanted to have battles, so you have to have armies. We wanted to have navies. You have to have the empire behind it. You have to have adversaries. We did all that stuff. I put all of that together. Dungeons and Dragons tells you this is a gelatinous cube and this is what it is. Here's the details of this monster. Here is a blink dog. This is what it does. To some extent, they're arbitrary. You know, it takes so many dice of hits. Well, that's pretty arbitrary. He could make it more. He could make it less. And I had trouble saying, here's the id monster. Here's the, we have no background unless you saw Forbidden Planet. You have no background what an id monster is. And unless you play that scenario, there's no reason to meet the id monster. So you don't meet it. I wanted to give players what I call makers now, systems to create things, creating creation systems. You know, even today, most science fiction computer games tell you here are 20 planets, and they've pre-structured them for you. Traveler gives you a million planets. It's just the results of die rolls. And you never know for sure what you're going to meet next if we're just rolling them up. We found that exciting. My playtesters found that exciting. I found it exciting to have an unlimited challenge, an unlimited selection of things to see. John Harshman was one of our designers. He's a brilliant man. The voice of reason so often. You know, would have some fantasy idea. I remember that he is the one who suggested the animal creation system. You go out into the great savanna of this continent, mostly going to be herds of antelope. Occasionally you'll find a tiger. Occasionally you'll find a big elephant. Except that they have six legs instead of four. They have, you know, they don't have a trunk. They do have a trunk, whatever it is. But the system meant our players never knew for sure what they were going to encounter. But in D&D, you memorize the monsters. So you know what to do when you encounter one. You never know what monster you're going to encounter in Traveler because the system is so filled with dice options.
Did that inform the idea of not having many illustrations in that? It's just a design classic, isn't it? Just those plain, beautifully set books.
We were an artist poor community in terms of a publisher. We did not have a strong stable of artists who knew the systems and could give us what we wanted. Traveler did not have illustrations because we didn't have artists, fine artists, sketch artists, illustrators who were on board with our program at the time. And so we did not have a lot of strong art to illustrate what we were doing. It was a good result because, like radio as opposed to television, you were forced to create it in your own mind,
yeah,
the images. The other thing was that we had grandiose ideas on what we wanted to do, but I spent most of my time designing this and creating and laying it out myself. When the time came to make the product itself, and you look at it, it's Dungeons and Dragons in space. D&D has three little books in a box. We'll do three little books in a box. It was selling for them. It should sell for us. That's the format. Why pioneer a new format? And so we didn't. We were going to do the same thing. But we came down to it, and because we were an illustrator poor organization, we didn't have any pictures to put on it. And I remember standing at the layout table with Rich Banner, our art director, and we're saying, what are we going to do? I had some idea that maybe we could, wrap the box in metal foil, make it look like the skin of a spaceship and whatever. But that was too hard, and we're coming down to it. What are we going to do? And Rich Banner says, well, let's see. And he chose Optima as the typeface. He put the name in. I'm the one who picked the double L spelling because I wanted something different. I also wanted to not be Star Adventurer or Star Kings or Space Fighters. I wanted to be independent of that easy naming convention. In an exercise in creative packaging, Rich said, we're just going to do it in all black. We're going to put a red stripe on it. We'll put the name of it up here. I wrote the text on what the Beowulf was doing because we needed to have something to get people's name. Here it is 50 years later, almost 50 years later, and people still love that distress call from the Beowulf. I should create this fiction that we had decided, we had studied, we had done something to make people understand this was different, but instead it was just the reality of what we were doing. But it did convince people it was different.
Of course, later you'd have people like Liz Danforth, and nobody does a Varga quite like Liz Danforth. Amazing.
Yes. And then we found some artists to do some work. I was responsible for a lot of the advertising, not only for Traveler, but for other things. And I came up with, I like formulas. I like a formula on how to build a spaceship. I like a formula on how to build a world. I like a formula on how to write the material on the box. And the principle that I came up with, you have to have a front that looks good for something, that makes people enjoy it, that gets their attention. And I decided that it should have three steps. I never know which is right brain and left brain, but you have a left brain thing that says an emotional appeal. This is fun. You will enjoy it. And then you have I usually start with the other one, which is the intellectual. It's got three books in it. It's got complete rules for science fiction role-playing. Intellectual appeal. If that interests you, that works. Then there's the emotional appeal, filled with space opera, the classic stuff that has thrilled people for ages. The emotional appeal. And then the third step is moving to a buying decision. Buy this home, you can play it tonight. Take this home, buy this, take it home, you can play it tonight. Step, step, step. And that's what we tried to do more or less successfully in all of our packaging. It just was very, very fortuitous that black box with red and white stuck out on the shelf in the game stores because it was so starkly different.
And the wonderful thing about Traveler for me is that there is an internal logic to it. So the thing that drives things are things like Jump takes 1 week to complete. And so the whole logic gives it a sense of authenticity. How's that evolved over time? And the Imperium developed as well, didn't it, out of it? And the whole mythology and lore around that as well.
You get into another concept that I think was important, is that the universe of Traveler is intuitively logical to anybody who picks it up. We don't have mental sciences that you have to use telepathy to talk to people. It's just talking. We have the various tech levels, of course, of primitive to fantastic. You still go to a kind of an airport and buy a ticket to get on kind of a spaceship airplane and go somewhere. Everybody understands that concept. You go into town and it's kind of like a television Western. You know, there's a place to stay for the night and there's a place to rent a car and there's a place to stop at a saloon to meet people and maybe you get in a fight. Maybe they'll tell you about gold in the hills. It's all logical to somebody who buys this game and starts playing it. You can encounter everything. We're not stuck in one massive dystopic situation or totally happy situation like Star Trek, which is always everybody's happy. And there's never labor strikes. There's never work stoppages. There's never plagues. Never happens on Earth. Everybody's happy on Earth all the time. Traveler lets the game master, the referee, present almost any situation to the players when they can handle.
And you've subsequently developed fiction in the Imperium. So what was that like? And because that's fairly recent, isn't it?
It is. And thank you for bringing that up. You know, I started a novel like the first year that we had Traveler, and I just didn't know how to do it. I think that novels take a maturity that I didn't have, and I was afraid to do it. Several years ago, when I had finished working on the fifth edition of Traveler, and it was all in my mind, I had fifth edition is the original three little black books expanded to something huge, trying to cover all the things that I've been working on for the last 40 years. And I just had this story in my mind of the agent of the Imperium. And I sat down and it was took me about 6 months to write it. And it was a revelation because it told me concepts that role-playing rules don't tell me. Mm. I mean, role-playing, I'm trying to give history and everything else, and I'm trying to lay that out. But I'm letting the game master run it. In the novel, I'm running. And it gave me the opportunity to also tell secrets of the universe, stories of the universe that I knew were already there. You know, we have a list of the emperors and empresses of the Imperium. And there's a point where there's a civil war and all these various emperors, there's a whole string of emperors, and each one kills the last one and takes the reins of power. And they're no more than a sentence each. And I've always been fascinated with them. I wonder what the story is about that. I wonder what the story is about this. Why was this empress killed in a tunnel collapse? How could that happen? I mean, who would put her in that situation that a tunnel could collapse on her and kill her? And I was fascinated with those ideas, and I wondered what the answers were. It's a curious situation. The novel is a curious situation because it covers 400 years of history with a guy kind of cruising through from year to year, from decade to decade, sometimes not knowing what's going to go on. I'm being deliberately obtuse. I think everybody out there should read that novel. It's worth reading. It's a deeper insight into Traveler than you get just reading the rules. Of course, it helps to have read the rules because then you understand some of it too.
Do you still play, Mark? Are you still playing Traveler?
You know, this is a confession I have. I rarely play. I occasionally run a game at conventions, but there are very few people. I don't play with enough people in a convention situation. It's better to have a seminar where I can put 100 people in the room and they all get something out of it than put 5 people at a table and they get something, and fewer people get something out of it. I did play a game recently at Gamehole Con in Madison, Wisconsin. We sat down, they all generated characters. We had 6 people. 5 of them were naval people, and 1 was a scout. 5 of them were men who kind of knew each other already. The scout was a girl. Interestingly enough, her social level was relatively low. Naval officers, and they're exploring a deck plan. And she says, "We should go to the bridge. We should find the bridge." And I had her roll social, and nobody paid any attention to her. And the guy next to her said, "We should go to the bridge." And he had a higher social level. And all his friends said, "Yeah, we should go to the bridge." And she's just kind of, "I just said that." And it got me a running joke because through the entire game, She was really smart. She really came up with some great ideas and never got any credit. And as soon as she mentioned it, everybody ignored her. And then somebody else would steal her idea and they would find the monster. And, you know, she really, if she'd had different statistics, she would have been the leader of the group. But instead, they just treated her terribly.
Yeah.
This is the joy of role playing.
Yeah. And a great throwback to On Guard that you mentioned as well. So that's still engine driving it. Yeah. Well, it's been great spending this time with you, Mark. So thank you very much. And thank you for all the joy that you've given me and my friends over the years, because it's been great being in your universe.
Well, you know, the universe is supposed to be welcoming. It doesn't mean you'll survive, but you're supposed to be welcoming. And I appreciate talking to you today. Thank you.
Judge by the Rules Revisited.
Welcome to the Room of Roleplaying Rambling. We're back up in the attic. We've got the pigeon with the white eye and two pink stubs for feet tapping on the window as we gather. Hello there, Blither.
Hello, Dirk.
We were going to do this in the pub, weren't we, last week?
We were, yeah. We were overtaken by events.
Well, it just got too busy. There's no right to be busy the last
Thursday's a new Friday. Well, once we used to go to the pub on Thursday. Sneaky half day off work, go to the pub on Thursday. It was dead, wasn't it? But now it does feel like...
People have, end of the week.
Do they work from home on a Friday? Is this working from home on a Friday thing? So now Thursday is a new Friday and they go to the pub after work or something like that, maybe.
Yeah.
It does feel a bit like that.
I'm sure it's very good for the hospitality industry, but... No, it's not good for us, recorded.
It's not good for us. We want a deserted pub, please.
Yeah.
Just for an hour or two.
Just so we can record this.
And also, it's not just noises in. It was also, went into the Lassagowrie pub. It went into the Snug, where we normally record. And there's a man in there. And he's every right to do this.
Yes.
In a free society. I'm not criticising him. I am a bit. But he was sat there, wasn't he, nursing a pint. Nursing a pint of Guinness and sitting there on his own. He wasn't bothering us, but it didn't feel like we could record an RPG podcast in front of him. No. Like he was a strange audience of sort that we don't want when we're recording it. So.
And that beer was evaporating quicker than
he was drinking it. Yeah, it was, wasn't it? So he was perfectly quiet. But it was just a bit weird.
Some people will be happy that we're up in the attic with just the pigeon for company. Because some people don't like. Some people like the hubbub of the pub.
Hubbub of the pub. The hubbub. The hubbub of the pub. Yeah.
And some people hate it. So this way we keep everybody happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, right. So we're looking at just by these rules.
Yeah. Traveller. Revisited.
Revisited.
The Elizabeth Taylor of role playing. I'm marrying it again. I'm Richard Burton to travel as Elizabeth Taylor. Here we go again.
And I've enjoyed playing it because I did run the Traveller Adventure, but we've got back into it with you refereeing it and playing it again.
Running the Pirates of Janax. Yeah. And a few one shots at conventions and things. I've got back into it in quite a big way, I have to say.
Yeah.
It's quite strange, isn't it? How these things come about, that I went from not really liking it. And having said that, I say not really liking it, I think, in my defence, we were quite young, weren't we?
Yeah.
When we played it, we were kids. And we also had a player, Simon, who didn't really like it. No. Therefore,
it was sabotaged.
Sabotaged a bit.
Yeah,
it was, which we've covered in another episode. It was sabotaged a bit. So in its defence, it wasn't entirely the game, although it did suffer from a certain blandness of design, didn't it? You know, there weren't many illustrations, wasn't very colourful. And some people like that, little black books, the Traveller little black books have got a sort of iconic RPG status, haven't they, which I can understand. But it did, for a kid, it lacked a bit of pizzazz, so to speak. Whereas now the Mongoose edition is far more kind of elaborate and fleshed out and has lots of bells and whistles on it. It's essentially the same game, but lots more going on in terms of worlds and aliens and pictures and illustrations and things.
It's showing 40 years of development, hasn't it? The Imperium and people playing in it, and that's made a difference.
Yeah.
I think your views on the rules, that when we covered them last time,
very early on, episode 3, I think it was, was jaundiced by your experience as a kid and those games. I used to enjoy playing it, as I said at the time.
Yeah.
But
well, I think it's your understanding of the world as well, because, again, when I was a kid, I never liked the idea. I could never quite get my head around the idea that it's the far future and there are planets with a tech level of 5 or 6, which is the equivalent of the 1930s on Earth. And you think, well, but you say, it's the far future. What? That doesn't make sense, does it? But of course, as an adult now, it makes perfect sense. It's quite a sophisticated game, and it's this kind of picture of the future that it gives. But when I was a kid, I didn't want sophisticated. I wanted laser pistols everywhere.
Even within our own culture, technology is not equally distributed.
Absolutely,
if you look around the world, it's only even distribution.
Yeah.
This idea that AI is going to either bore us all to death or take all over all our jobs is far removed from the fact that you have to fill in paper forms every time you go to the doctors or do anything that you want to do.
That's exactly the thing, isn't it? So you got like travelers to where you go on a planet and it's like low tech. Well, how do you square this with the fact that there's a spaceport, there's a starport? You think, yeah, but there's a starport. But as you say, on our planet, on Earth in the 21st century, there are bits of Earth that are incredibly technologically advanced. And there are bits that aren't.
And more analog.
It's obvious. But when I was a kid, I didn't appreciate that. And now I really appreciate it. I think it's a really interesting aspect of the traveler universe. High tech, but equally, there are low-tech problems. The idea that jump spaces are weak.
As I say in the interview with Mark Miller, there's a kind of logic that defines the world that is the idea that jump takes a week.
Yeah.
As a nice logic about it, it feels like a place that has an authenticity, even though it might not be scientifically accurate. It's got enough there to make you feel, oh, yeah, I can believe that.
And I suppose a parallel, and I think I remember reading this when I was a kid, of it being like a kind of far future version of the sort of 18th century.
Yeah.
18th century, you've got sail ships, takes a long time to get somewhere, but you can get somewhere.
Yeah.
And things like piracy, for example, went on in the 17th and 18th centuries. And it was hard to catch the pirates because you couldn't move that fast. It is a parallel.
Yeah,
of that, you know. And again, as a kid, I remember thinking, "What?" But now I think, "Oh yeah, of course." If you look at that period of Earth's history, that essentially what traveller is. So, like the East India Trading Company.
Yeah.
So at the moment in Parsa-Junak, you're dealing with the General Development Company in the Trojan Reach, and they're like the East India Company.
Yeah.
Slightly, almost like a government, slightly dodgy, slightly corrupt, kind of imperialistic power.
Exploitative,
all those things. That's exactly what they're like. Yeah.
And the idea, and we discussed this when we first discussed travel, the idea of communication, moving in that same pace.
Mm.
So you can beat a message moving from one system to another.
Yeah. You can stay ahead of the law. You can stay ahead of things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can intercept a message, that kind of thing, because it's not just, you know, everything's linked up, even money, credits. You'd have to carry credits with you, wouldn't you? Because if you go to some backwater planet, you can't just log on to your internet banking because you're in another star system. And all those things, as an adult gamer, as a grown-up gamer, are fascinating. But when I was a kid, they were just irritating.
Yeah,
it's like a maturity to the game that you appreciate when you get older, you know, whereas when I was a kid, I didn't really appreciate those things. I just wanted it to be like Star Wars. Why did I care whether it was really a futuristic representation of the 18th century? I don't want that. But now I do want that.
So we're going to talk about that in a bit more depth, and particularly some of the mechanical changes that you've enjoyed as you're refereeing again. But I mean, normally at this point, you have a prefab sprout game, but I'm not done one for this.
Well, I've done a prefab sprout. I've done a prefab sprout on you.
Have you?
I have. I've been looking at the Traveller star map because there's so many worlds. I've got some worlds here, but one of them is Ringo. One of them is a made-up one.
This is going to be difficult because they all have Names, like, get one that's called Kevin. Or
yeah, exactly. That's why. And I've gone, yeah, that's exactly.
Have I predicted one that's called Kevin?
No, you've not, but there's an interesting one, but we'll come to that. Whether it's a real one or not, it's a matter of discussion.
But the rules of a prefab spread game.
Where I've got here five planets.
Five
traveler planets, right? But one of them I have made up. Okay. One of them I have made up.
Right, okay. Here goes.
And I would say to anybody, if you want a slightly transcendental experience, go on the Traveller Star Map online, Traveller Wiki Star Map, and you could just lose hours of your life staring at it. It is an incredible thing. It's like fan-produced, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's the whole of the Traveller universe all there. You can zone in on any little bit, and you could spend the rest of your life just looking at weird planets and then Google them on the Traveller Wiki, and it'll tell you about them.
It's like Google Maps, but for the universe.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's exactly what it is. It's an incredible thing. Incredible. Anyway, here we go. Okay. System number one.
Number one.
Egypt. In the Eglinton subsector of the Spinwood Marches. Egypt. Egypt is a colonization training base. It has domes containing simulated environments, with the final test being survival on Egypt's surface of insidious hydrogen atmosphere.
So Egypt.
It's Egypt's training place for imperial training colony for training people to live in hostile environments. And it has some alien, well, they're kind of like aliens. They are genetically engineered humans called the Jonkareen, who've been genetically enhanced for desert-adapted living.
Presumably, the Jonkareen was the original name of the first clone, was it? Jonkareen?
I don't know. It's not Jonkareen. It's all one word, Jonkareen.
All right.
I don't know. Don't know.
Jonkareen.
Oh, yeah, I do if I've made it up. I make anything, can't I? It's a double bluff.
Jonkareen of Egypt, a hostile environment.
Egypt, the planet of Egypt. Okay.
Okay, Egypt.
That's one.
I'll write that down.
Next one.
Yeah.
Corfu. I always remember this from when we were a kid. It made me chuckle, Corfu, because it's like people went there on holidays. Corfu, don't. That's in the Aramis subset of the Spinwood Marches. An agricultural world with significant archaeological sites of the ancients. Amber zone, because Corfu's population was stricken with a virulent pathogen known as the Corfu claw virus.
All right.
While not possessing high lethality rate, the disease is quite debilitating, and the planet was interdicted by the Imperium to prevent off-world transmission. That's Corfu.
Corfu
and the Corfu claw virus. Okay. Okay, the next one.
Egypt, Corfu.
You'll like this one.
At the moment, it's ending like Thompson's.
The Thompson's holiday brochure, isn't it? Yeah. Judy Chalmers will be appearing.
Go on.
The next one. You'll like this one. If it's real, you'll like it. Maybe you'll like it if it's not real. Dirk.
The Dirk.
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 Planet Dirk. In the Rift Deep subsector of the Reavers Deep sector. It's a world alone. Dirk is the only planet orbiting a binary star system. Dirk's primary export is industrial-grade diamonds. Extensive volcanic activity on the world makes locating diamonds easy, if somewhat dangerous, to the habitat. Domes protecting the population are located in the centre of tectonic plates. So it's a mining colony, basically. A
mining colony for diamonds,
Dirk.
Alone, isolated.
Yeah.
Filled with self-loathing.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you relate to that anyway?
Dirk's world.
The next one is Grog.
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 This is
Chant. Chant subsector of the core sector. Another amber zone.
Yeah.
Another amber zone. A cold, inhospitable world of rock and wasteland. Once an agricultural garden world. However, a catastrophic accident at a research base on the planet resulted in all life being wiped out from the planet. Life slowly returning as colonizers using the old research station as a habitat. A significant group of Varga Corsairs are rumored to use the planet as a hideout. That's Grog.
A Varga secret base.
Grog. Okay.
Okay.
Finally,
last one.
The glamorously named Sheffield Sheffield.
Sheffield.
It's on the Knight Rim subsector, the Reavers Deep sector. Okay.
Nah.
Sheffield is pleasant, tropical island world, large islands, each governing themselves. Each island is a specific to one branch of the defence forces, and personnel retire there from their imperial military duties. Although each island is fiercely protective of their independence, and there's never any conflict, every 2 years there are inter-forces games. During this two-week period, bones have been known to be broken.
Okay.
So it's a planet where imperial troops retire to and live on different islands, all linked to their own
regiments
or services, yeah. So there you go. You've got Egypt.
Egypt, so it's
Corfu.
Yeah.
So Iluk, Grog, and Sheffield.
Okay. So I'm going to take Corfu out straight away because that's in the Aramis subsector, and I spent a long time in the Aramis subsector.
So maybe give away that one.
Yeah, and we used to laugh about that, didn't we?
Did.
Sheffield, the retirement home for vets. I'm a bit suspicious of that. Egypt, I was very convinced by the setting of that. And that's the thing with Traveller Worlds, isn't it? That stories into themselves. Mm, that's part of the brilliant. You land on a planet and the idea of these super genetic
desert dwellers.
Yeah.
Mm.
Brilliant. It sounds a lot like Stargate, that one. So I don't know whether you've robbed that one from somewhere else.
Okay.
Grog and Dirk seem a bit on the nose, but I think one of these is suspicious. And I think Grog is the suspicious one. So I think it's between Grog and Sheffield. And I'm going to land on Grog being the...
You're going to land on Grog
as a prefab sprite.
As a prefab sprite. Well, you wouldn't be landing on Grog because it is a free prefab sprite. Well done. Oh, you've got the prefab sprite. Grog is the one I made up, yeah.
Excellent.
All the others are real ones. Well, they're not real, but... and I got the details about them from... the Traveller Wiki page.
Yeah, but...
Which is interesting because you do sometimes get two or three descriptions of the same world. Fans have put different interpretations of the world on.
Right.
It's quite interesting, that, isn't it? Because there's other fan-based role-playing worlds that people have problems with, naming no names. But the Traveller one just seemed quite open, quite fluid, a bit more... All the fans have contributed to it, but there's still a sense of, do what you want with it.
Yeah. A bit of,
nothing's really canon, particularly.
No.
It's up to you, you know, what you do with things.
Yeah. Because it's on a whole planet, isn't it? So
even
if you took all of the descriptions as being accurate, they could have things happening.
Yeah, different things, I suppose. Different, yeah.
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 Absolutely. Well, there, well done. Grog.
Grog, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for that. I like doing the prefabs break, yeah. Now it's over to you. So back to joining Blythe rules. So you've got to pick three highlights.
Three highlights. From,
so this is looking at the new
rules. The Mongoose second edition. Yeah.
And then something that you want to, that you'd rather it didn't do already. Yeah. So let's start with the highlights. What are your three things?
The highlights are the effect rule. I like the effect rule.
Okay. Right. Effect rule. We'll talk about that.
Character creation.
Character creation, classic, and I think that came up previously. That
yeah, one. Yeah. Well done, but you know, I think it much improved. And Starship Combat,
yeah.
Starship Combat.
I'm looking forward to talking about that because that has been my favourite element of playing Pirates of Drinnix, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I'll talk about that. Yeah. Let's start about the effect rule. So remind people what that is.
Well, that's a rule that wasn't in the original game, but it's still the same core system, isn't it? So it's still predominantly roll 8 or more on 2d6 and add your skill. And you also add your stat modifier now, which you didn't in the original game. But it's essentially the same game. It's not unfamiliar territory. Yeah. So, and sometimes it does have the option to make things harder by making the 10 or more or 6, or easier with a 6 or more. But the general rule is 8 or more, 2d6.
And it's surprisingly difficult to do that.
It is.
We said that about Savage Worlds, didn't you?
Sounds easy. Start rolling dice, suddenly it becomes really.
Really tricky at main moments. Yeah.
So that's the, but they bring in this rule called effect, which is the idea that in some situations, not all situations, but some situations, how well you do over eight matters. So the best example is combat. So if you roll a 10 rather than an 8, you get an effect of 2. Because you've got 8, but 9, 10, 2 over 8, you get an effect of 2, basically. And what you do in combat is you add that to your damage. Okay. So again, it kind of makes a bit more sense sometimes. Those pistols that do 3d6 damage and you think it's not a lot for a gun. But of course, if you're good with it, you're going to add your effect to it.
Yeah.
That bumps up the damage. And I think in Pirates of Trinity, that's been quite a factor, hasn't it? With some weapon.
Oh, definitely.
When you get an effect of 5 or 6, and suddenly you're getting 5 or 6 damage added to 4d6. The lethality goes through the roof, really.
It has that pleasurable effect that when you roll high, get a good roll, you're getting reward for
it. Yeah, reward for it, yeah. Exactly, yeah. You're not just, the guy who's getting an 8 and the guy who's getting 12, there is a marked difference in what happens with their roll and damage. Yeah.
Which a lot of early games in the 80s are kind of reaching for, but there was no material effects. So I'm learning how to play West End Games Star Wars, and that is pitting your D6s against your opponent's D6s. And if you're the highest, you win. And in the rules, it says try and make it more spectacular. If it's higher, it's much higher.
Yeah.
But this way is a good way of making sure that when you roll high, it makes a difference.
And it reminds me a little bit of the Fate rules with that ladder of success thing in Fate, as in Fate, where, you know, if you get certain higher results, it's better. And it's good as a games master as well, because you can use it in quite imaginative ways. So, for example, if you're sneaking into somewhere and you make a stealth roll, you can say as a games master, well, if you fail, the effect, because it works the other way as well.
Yeah.
The effect by which you fail is how many guards you encounter. So if you roll a 6, you're going to encounter 2 guards. Roll a 4, you encounter 4 guards.
Yeah.
So you can use it in kind of imaginative ways, because I think we did that in the last game, didn't we? There were drones. And I said, well, the effect by which you fail, I think someone really rolled badly and failed by 5.
Probably me.
Rogue failed by 5. It's around, well, that's how many there are. You failed by 5, therefore there's 5 of these things. So it's quite a neat little rule that allows you to kind of, as a player, you're rewarded for success.
Yeah.
But as games master, you can play around with it to kind of say, well, the degree by which you fail or succeed, you can give people things based on that particular number.
Yeah, and it gets rid of that binary thing of, oh, you've been successful or you've failed. It gives a bit more colour. It
gives a bit more colour and a bit more. And, of course, some of the, well, we'll come on spaceship combat, the spaceship combat rules use it for getting critical roles and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do think it's a nice little addition. You could argue it's not the most imaginative thing in the world, but it's a, as you say, it makes the game more colourful based compared to the old system where it was just 8 or more success, fail, that's it. It adds a bit more to it, adds a bit more depth and richness to what's going on.
It's so sensible that it feels like it should have been there all the time in many ways. But it does work. I wonder how you feel, because in Pirates of Trinity that we're doing at the moment, we're also using the optional luck rule.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that and having that in the game?
I think you kept alive. But I don't mind it. I mean, there's a few optional rules, isn't there? There's a sanity rule and there are morale rules, and there's even a wealth rule in it as well, which I think is quite good, an optional wealth rule in the companion where you have a wealth score rather than tracking credits. You have a wealth score that can go up and down depending on what you buy, where you buy it. But I think the luck rule is.
So the luck way it works is that you've got a certain amount and you stack it onto your roll before you roll.
Before you roll,
to boost it. So that if you want to assure a success, you might want to add your skill, add your attribute, bonus plus a couple from your luck.
But it operates like a stat as well. So if you've got a luck of 9, for example, and you need to make a luck roll, then you need 8 or more. And because you've got a luck of 9, you can add 1 to that roll. But of course, if you've spent luck during the game and your luck's on 3, you're going to get a penalty on your luck roll because it's like a stat that you've burnt it, haven't you?
Yeah.
So there's two sides to it. There's the luck roll thing as well as burning luck. Yeah. So there's been times where you've needed to make a luck roll and people have failed because they've burnt too much luck.
It has kept us alive, and I wouldn't want to put an argument forward that we should get rid of it.
Of course.
However, I do think it imbalances it a little bit in that, because we run it in 2-hour sessions and it refreshes it at the end of it.
Yeah.
It feels like we're leaning on the luck allocation and that's too much.
Yeah, and I think it's true actually of any game that has a luck mechanic.
Yeah.
In that if it's a one shot or if it doesn't involve much in the way of rolling, you can exploit luck. So for example, in Pirates of Drunax, if it's a session that's a little bit more talky, a bit more negotiating, you can feel confident of burning a bit of luck. Whereas if it's heavily combat based, you might go, well, maybe not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet. Because I know in some of the Starship combat, there's been those discussions. I'm going to put some luck into it. And people go, no, not yet. Let's see how this goes before we burn luck. Because you know you're going to be making more dice rolls. You know. But I think that's true of that. I've noticed that in any luck, any game. Yeah. Call of Cthulhu one shots, people will burn luck. DCC, people burn it because they think, it's a one shot or it's going to reset next time.
Yeah, but we're playing in campaign mode. It's just that I wonder whether, because we're doing it in short 2-hour sessions,
it is
having more influence on the game than if we were doing it in a 4-hour block.
Yeah, it does. On the plus side, though, Pirates of Drunax is quite pulpy in the way it runs.
Yeah.
It is supposed to be like Blake 7, and I think having luck allows you to be a little bit more daring, maybe. It's like some of the negotiations. You last time, I think, engaged in a negotiation with a warlord from Ogma, slaver warlord character, and you put a bit of luck into it and did the roll, and that worked quite nicely, I thought. Whereas maybe without the luck, you probably failed.
Yes.
Because I'm kind of conscious that in Pirates of Drunax, I don't think you want to fail all that much, because you do want it to... The idea of it is you want to drive it forward and it become like, you know, you're daring space pirates, aren't you?
Yes.
That's where you are. So
yeah. I agree with you. And the next one you've got is character creation, which we've covered before, but that is the famous element of Traveller. Have you got a T-shirt saying, I've died of character creation?
No, but I keep looking for one and can never find one. I don't know where people get them from. No, but I think the character creation in the new version is... It's very similar, obviously. It is very similar.
So it's a life path
thing. Life path thing, yeah. But I suppose that I don't think in the original rules he would describe it as a life path.
No.
I mean, it was in a way a life path. I don't think it felt like a life path. It just felt like a way of accumulating skills and money.
Yeah.
Whereas in the new rules, it does feel like a life path. So when you fail a survival roll, you don't die. You just have to roll on a mishap table, don't you? So you might be injured or something bad's happened to you. And then there's roles for contacts and events and stuff like that. So that feels, it does feel now more like a life path creation model rather than just for 5 terms in the Marines and let's hope I get gun combat and a ship at the end of it or whatever.
Yeah. And all that stuff where you're developing, I suppose people call it a backstory, don't they? Where you're developing that. It's only useful if you use it in the game, isn't it?
And
I think we all have used our past and brought it into the game.
And I think it says in the rules, and we did this for Pirates of Drunax, it does say roll your characters together.
Yeah.
And where there are those connections, you can draw connections between characters where they make contacts, can be the other player, brings people together. And also, the new rules, there's just more careers to go at as well, isn't there? So you can be like a criminal or maybe a barbarian, can't you? I mean, I think some of those careers, I think, were in the original game, but they came in like later supplements, didn't they?
Yeah.
So it's not like the new, but it does feel like it's more part of the standard game that you don't have to go down a military career, do you?
No.
You can go down non-military careers. You could be an entertainer, for example. which are sort of interesting career paths that you could go down. So I think it's much improved in that sense, both in terms of it is a life path thing now, and you've got a broader option of things that you can get involved in as a character.
Yeah.
You don't all have to be Space Marines, Naval officers and Army officers, do you? You can still be those things, but you know, you don't have to be those things.
I think what I'd add to it as well is what I get a sense of with this over and above our experience of doing the travel adventure, which we did a few years ago, is that sense of true play. So we've got our player characters, but we've also got a crew that we've enlisted.
Yeah.
And those characters, in a lot of ways, feel as real as the player characters because they get characterised as well, don't they?
Yeah. Quite telling that they don't have luck because they're not player characters. Two of them are dead.
Yeah, that's
two of them have been killed. Tell you something.
But it allows, what that allows in the way that we're playing it, it allows us to have crew members so that we can all be part of it when we're doing planet side stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas my character's on board ship usually because he's a pilot, but it allows me to participate because we've got that crew. Oh, strong feel of character. And I think when we play the Traveller Adventure, we've really sensed that as well.
Yeah.
Your last one is Starship Combat.
Starship Combat, yeah. It's a strange one, this, because I suppose in the end comes from experience in that I've played now more games that have Starship Combat in than just Traveller. Because again, going back to Pirates of Trinidad, there's been quite a bit of Spaceship Combat in that because you're pirates. One good thing about it is there's always something for people to do.
Yes.
So I can remember when we played Star Trek.
Yeah.
And if you're Star Trek, and I was the pilot. And I think the only two things I could do was like offensive or defensive maneuver, and that was it. Attack pattern or defensive pattern, that was it. Every round was all I could do. Whereas in Traveller, there's a lot going on. If you're the pilot, you've got options, you've got thrust, you can move closer, you can use some of it to dodge, some of it to manoeuvre into a better position. If you're a gunner, obviously you're shooting, so that's fun. You've got different computer programs you can run as well. You've got sensors, haven't you? Sensor locking onto a target, so someone can do that. You've got things an engineer can do as well.
Yeah.
But divert some power. Well, there's things for all the, you know, an average bunch of players, four or five players in a starship battle, everyone doing something.
And again, like we said about effect, it does have a material impact on what happens because of the decisions that you make.
Yes.
And it feels more tactical than I remember it being.
Yeah. I think it's a bit easier. I mean, you got rid of all that vector stuff that made me throw the book at the wall, that sort of stuff where you think, for God's sake, you know, so it's a lot. It's a lot simple. It's not, I don't think it's necessarily simple. It's not that complicated, but it's a bit of a bugbear with any kind of vehicle and spaceship combat role playing game, isn't it?
Yeah.
How simple and complicated do you make it? Because if you make it too simple, it can become boring. If you make it too complicated, it can become too complicated.
Yeah.
It's striking the balance so that there's enough going on for all the players to feel involved. I think that's the trick that everyone's involved. If it's just the pilot and the gunner and everyone else is stood about, it's quite dull for them. Whereas in Traveller, there is stuff, there's lots of stuff you can be doing, even if you're not. Yeah.
There are decisions to be made, but it is quite procedural and set out, isn't it?
So you
know at which points to make the decisions, and there's always some debate on how to use thrust, for example, whether we're going to be defensive or offensive. And we're doing a lot more of it because we're pirates. So you start to adopt then your mode of operation, your rules of engagement. And as you say, by using computers, you can try infiltration and try.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things you can do that are kind of quite good fun without it becoming dull. It's not just shooting, them shooting at you shoot back, they shoot at you shoot back. There is that, obviously.
And there's nothing more terrifying, exciting that the thought of torpedoes heading towards you.
Yeah, the missile rules are quite good, aren't they? They're quite deadly. And salvo missiles coming towards you, and you can lock onto them and try and disable them, but here they keep coming and coming and coming and getting nearer and nearer. And you know, if you get hit by missiles, it's really, really bad.
Yeah, and the critical rules, as you've explained, make a big difference, don't they? Yeah.
Kind of nice critical rules as well, because there's two ways you can get criticals. Is if you're losing 10% of your hull. So there's an attritional element. If you just get hit with loads of damage, you're going to take a critical. But also, you don't have to do a lot of damage. It's to come back to that effect thing. If you get an effect of 6 or more, you take 5 off the effect, and that's the level of critical. If you get effect of 6, you get a level 1 critical, get effect of 7. And it is possible to get those effects because on 2 dice, because as you said, there's lots of tactical decisions that give you pluses on your dice roll. So you can end up rolling with quite a lot of pluses on that give you an effect that's high. So a small ship can actually do a crit on a much bigger ship if it's accurate. That kind of, so there's two elements in there. There's pounding the ship with damage, like missiles, just doing loads of damage, do a critical, but also a well-placed laser shot can take out a fuel tank or something like that.
It is exciting because the stakes are very high because if the ship goes, you're dead.
I think there was one fight as well last year, the first season, where you encountered a rival pirate and it was touch and go, I think. There was a point where I thought, ooh, this could be a TPK, but I think you managed to just destroy him before you just completely destroyed the ship before he destroyed yours.
And there's also that calculation that we're making, which I'm enjoying, of the damage and us making a risk and reward assessment, whether we've taken so much damage now that it's going to cost us so much to repair them. Is it worth pursuing?
Because it's piracy. I think as you pointed out, there was one where everyone was going, come on, let's destroy them. And you said, well, no. We're supposed to steal the cargo. We are pirates.
Yeah.
What you want is just get them to surrender, pound them till they surrender, disable them, and then take the stuff and blow them up.
Andy's got a desire to blow everything up.
I gotta like it when you blow things up, but I know what you mean. The whole point is you are pirates. You're supposed to steal stuff.
Yeah.
Well, who knew as well, in Patrick's insurance would be so important. The whole point is that these crews, these traders have insurance on the goods. So there comes a point where they go, you know what, I can have it, and I'll just claim on the insurance.
Yes. And there's a complicated arrangement that Michael's suggesting, where we actually have an insurance company. We haven't quite worked that out yet, though, have we?
Yeah, have an insurance company and insure people and, some kind of scam.
It's very complicated.
Well, I think one thing Michael suggested was trying to find out who the biggest insurer was on the Trojan Reach, get hold of their data banks and go after those ships or something like that. And I'm thinking, the insurance brokers of Drinax. How exciting.
We're already accountants.
Accountants of Drinax. The insurance brokers of Drinax.
It's all very exciting. Good. So what would you say is the low point?
I still think sometimes it can be a little bit sciencey. So occasionally you do get bits in it where you think, why have you kept that in? There must be a simpler way of doing it. So one of them is...
So by science, it is science fiction.
It is science fiction, but for example, so when you're firing a laser, pulse laser from your spaceship, it's not really taking into account the science, is it? I mean, it is in a rudimentary way. It's a laser. It hits another ship 10,000 kilometers away in space and it does some damage. So there's a science in it. Give you that it's not making you do some weird calculation about the length of the range and how much, you know, it says like if it's such a range, get a +2 on it. It doesn't go, well, actually what you need to calculate is the distance, there are also solar flares, some space dust, maybe debris from other ships. You're gonna have to calculate an equation to work out how effective that shot is,
right?
Okay. That might be a more scientific approach, but it doesn't do that, does it?
Right.
And quite rarely it doesn't do it. But then occasionally there's still little bits in there. So, for example, there's a thing about to make a jump, you have to be outside the gravitational field of the planet that you're taking off from, right? That's fine. That makes sense, yeah?
But then there's something about like working out the different diameters, how many planetary diameters you're away from the planet. And you look at it and you think, yeah, necessary. Is that necessary? Is it necessary to be so bothered about that bit of science, but not other bits? Do you see what I mean?
Do all that and then call it Brian or whatever.
Yeah. call it Sheffield.
Anyway.
So yeah, I think sometimes there's still a little bit of science in it. And maybe that's me just being a couple of bits. I don't know.
Don't you get, we should let him to the door. I think he's chomping at the bit at the door. It's the high horse, letting the high horse.
I was bringing the high horse. I've been in for ages.
No, here he comes. Because you have a bit of a thing about the additions as well, don't you? Because we could never quite settle on which edition we were using.
Oh, yeah. What? Don't bring out a new edition that's hardly any different. Just stick to one. Either do a new through a third edition.
So how did they do it? They bring out a new one, like Windows 95?
They did a core update in 2022, didn't they? Which right. is actually a better, it is a much better robot. It's a bit cleaner, a bit better written, but it does change one or two rules. So the critical rules, I think Starship Combat critical rules are slightly different. So people would, you always get an annoying thing where they bring out a new edition of the rules and they say, it's just a few rule tweaks.
When
you say that, you can't say that, can you, to people like us?
No.
You can't say that to me, who's running the Parish's Renax for the next 3 years of his life, and go, you don't need the new one. You don't need the new one, do you? Yeah. You don't need the new one. I think you do need the new one. Yeah. So just
leave it.
Just do. It's not so much leave it. I think it's more. Just do another edition. Do a third edition.
Have a clean break.
Have a clean break and do a third. Just don't produce a new edition and go, you don't need the old one. I think you'll find I do. Either go for broke and do a third edition or leave it alone. Stop tweaking. The thing with any game system, isn't it? It's a bit like Savage Worlds with the old adventure, the old
Explorer's Edition.
People go, well, there's not much difference. Doesn't matter. There is quite a bit of difference. And yeah, I need the new one.
There's enough difference.
Yeah.
There's enough difference to make a difference.
Yeah. Because I did have Savage Worlds. I think I had the Explorer one. And it was only a few months later that the new one came out. And I remember thinking, I'll be all right. But I'm not. And I bought the new one.
But at least it's clear. I think that's the bit with the Mongoose rules. Yeah. It's making sure you're all on the same page because there have been iterative changes and they've done like releases that are like, is it like errata or is it just additional rules?
Just slightly different tweaks of the rules, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tweaks of the rules. So I think that critical rule on space combat is different.
Yeah.
But it's just.
Well, it's good to see the high horse occasion.
Good to see him, yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Back into Traveller. Who knew it?
Yeah. It's great. I mean, we just had a bit of a go at Mongoose now about the editions. But they have done a fantastic job on it. And the books they've done. I mean, I am slightly addicted to buying the Traveller books, you know, the different sectors of space and the alien books and all the stuff they've done. It is fantastic, really. It's a really good space sort of universe. And of course, as I think we've said before, it is a toolkit, so you can use it for other science fiction things as well,
which
is great. You know, it's really, really good game. Won't be either, but I can't see a divorce on the cards. It's this time.
No.
Gonna last.
Cheers. Thanks, Pliny.
I'll get me coat.
We're heading towards the door. We've got our coats on, but it's still time for a bit of closing time chatter.
Okay. What's on your mind, Dirk?
I'll tell you what's on my mind.
What's on your mind?
Is you doing reverse ferrets on something that I need to share with
our listeners. I knew this would come up. Well, I changed my mind again.
Several years ago, I did that thing on Facebook. You're not on Facebook.
I'm not on Facebook.
Is it an ethical ground that you don't do it on?
It's just, I struggle with social media at the best of times. And I feel like I'm on Twitter and on Blue Sky. And I'm on Discord, but not that you know it, because I don't do much on it, but Facebook, just one too many things. It's like when I joined, I think when lockdown happened, if this is me on social media, when lockdown happened,
yeah,
I have a guitar lesson, right? And I couldn't go to the guitar lesson because it was lockdown. So he said, well, we'll do it over WhatsApp. Right, okay. So I did them over WhatsApp, video, yeah. WhatsApp. So I had to open the WhatsApp account. So I opened the WhatsApp account and I did the guitar lessons. And that's all I did on WhatsApp. I didn't do anything else in it. And my mum, few months later, my mum said, your sister's a bit upset at you. So why? She sent you a message. She sent you a text message. You didn't reply, but ignoring her. I said, talking about? I looked at my phone. I said, did you not send me a text message? You've been sending text messages to? Well, she sent them to you. She'd been messaging me on WhatsApp. I'd be completely ignoring you because I didn't look at it. Because I just thought,
that's just for guitar lessons.
That's all it's for. I'm not getting involved in this. Yeah. I'm not getting involved in another social media.
The worst thing about Facebook, I always say, it puts everybody you know in the same room as your mum. And then you can
that's good enough reason to not be on it.
Yeah. a few years ago, it was late at night. Drink might have been involved.
Oh, don't use drink as an excuse. Because I'm going to use drink as an excuse in about 5 minutes, but go on.
And I started looking up people that we went to school with and friending them with the purpose of kind of doing a bit of research to see how things are.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit creepy the way that I'm presenting.
No, you're putting it like that, yeah. But I know what you mean. You kind of...
It's curiosity.
It's curiosity of this thing with social media that once you see somebody or find someone you used to know a long time ago on social media, the natural inclination is to think, I wonder what they're up to now.
Yeah.
And have a look. Yeah. I know what you mean.
And really all you get is endless profile pictures of people holding up beer.
Holding up beer, oh yeah.
With a ring around it saying, I love the NHS or something like that. Yeah. You get just an endless.
You actually get no insights whatsoever.
No.
Very rare do you get an insight, yeah.
But I also joined a school group that we were in school. And this year is 40 years since we left school. And so our old classmates, our classmates put out a thing to say, hey gang, we're going to have a reunion. Let's get together.
Yeah.
Good to see the old gang together. And they're going to do it at this club. I roll back straight away. Thanks for the offer. I won't do it. I won't be able to attend. Thank you. And so last week.
Did you say that?
Yeah.
Oh, you actually put that in writing, did you?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I said.
I thought you mentioned that.
I did. As soon as I told you, as soon as I got there, I said, I'm not going.
No, no, yeah.
Because I didn't want to get persuaded by you to go.
Well, let's initially when you told me we're on a JBO and you told me and I'd had one pint of beer.
Yeah.
And at that point I said, no way, no way.
Yeah.
Good, I'm not going. Yeah, we're not going. After 5 pints of beer, I decided it might be quite a laugh to go.
Yeah. But the other elements of this is that it's been organised by those mean girls at the back who used to mock us for playing Star Frontiers.
They did, yeah. There were three of them, weren't there, who used to take the mickey out of us for playing D&D. And maybe would, if we went, would do.
They still do, yeah.
But I've since changed my mind. I've gone through, no. Five, possibly 6 pints of beer, yes.
Very enthusiastic, yes. Very enthusiastic.
5 or 6 pints of beer.
You convinced me.
I know.
I'd had 5 or 6.
Well, you'd had 5 or 6. We'd had the same amount of beer. We were in a range. So.
But I'd already said no.
Yeah, but you'd had beer. You had beer. I had beer. I said, yeah. You said, yeah, that would be great. You messaged them and said, we're coming. I mean, you didn't need to do that.
I said, I'm sorry. I've now found out that I can't attend.
You have now found out I can't attend. Hello. I've just had 5 or 6. Possibly even 7, but no, we lost count. Pints of beer. I now found I can attend.
So I got the details of where it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know. But then I've changed my mind.
You looked it up and you said, oh, I know that place. Well, I went to a 40th birthday.
But now I've changed my mind and I think it's probably a bad idea.
So I've
But I might change my mind again. Who knows? Who knows? Unpredictable. We just need, it's there, isn't it, in the diary.
Yeah.
We might go, we might not. Whatever you do, don't put a poll on social media.
Yeah.
Because then you will be bound to it, won't we? All right? Do not put a poll on social media. Should we go to the reunion? Unless it's a poll that says, should we go to the reunion? No is one answer. Absolutely not is the other. I'll accept it.
Well, I think our listeners should decide. I'm going to put it to a poll.
We should put it's nothing to do with role playing, apart from the fact that the three mean girls will be there. And they're instrumental in organising it.
What do you mean it's nothing to do with role playing? It's going back to 1984 when we were in the thick of our role playing experience.
And you know, we'll walk in and people might say, do you still play those stupid games? We'd be stuck with the choice of going no or going, yeah. Yeah, we do. Do you?
Oh, this could rumble on.
Yeah. But at the moment, we're not going. It could all change.
It could all change because we're currently drinking two rather cold cups of tea.
Yeah. But once we get back on the beer,
anything can happen.
Anything could happen. Like, we could say we're going and then change our mind again.
Cheers, Blair.
Goodbye.
The Save Rap podcast covers old school gaming and the modern games inspired by them. Listen in to hear about games from the 70s and 80s, as well as their modern descendants. You can download episodes wherever podcasts are found on iTunes, Google, and other fine podcast distributors. You should also check them out on saverhap.com or email them at saverhappodcast@gmail.com.
Oh, school reunion. That means I have 3 months to lose 3 stone. And make something of my life. Anyway, I want to give a huge thank you to Mark for spending time with us in the room of Roleplaying Rambling and sharing some of his experiences. I'm sure you'll agree that it was fascinating to learn so much about those early days of Traveller. We're really loving playing the game again. I did promise last time that this year was going to be the year of science fiction. So, to put our money where our mouth is, in May, me and Blythe are heading to North Star, a science fiction themed convention in Sheffield. I've decided to fulfil a long-held desire to convert the 2000 AD strip, The Mean Arena, into a one-shot. And Blythe, on the other hand, is finally going to bring his Savage Worlds Blake 7 to the table. You'll notice that we've fallen out of step a bit with our release schedule, but don't worry, we'll catch up and we'll ensure that there's still 12 to 13 new Grog Pods released in 2024. Look out soon as well for the long-promised Book Club Extra, which is going to be dropped on the Patreon feed. This is the Q&A sessions that we have when guests come to the book club. The very best way to keep up to date with what's happening with the Grog Squad is to follow the Grog Pod Discord server. If you want an invitation, contact me at dirkthedice@gmail.com. That's dirkthedice@gmail.com. With the economy and everything seeming a bit rubbish at the moment, I'm very conscious that the contributions made by patrons are even more valuable as the cost of living crisis continues to make it difficult to contribute. Thank you to those supporters, past and present, who have thrown coins in the beret to help to keep this show on the road and continue to encourage us to come up with new stuff. We've got some new patrons becoming honorary members of the Armchair Adventurers Club too. Putting up their feet on a fancy poof is Adam Keeper, Delhi Counter Culture, and Mohammed Sadiq. Thank you. At the So Far So Good level, I like to give an award from the virtual gift from the rule books under discussion, and this time it's from the Traveller Supplies. So let's have a roll. That's a 6. So Chris Miles, who's upgraded to a sofa, he gets a disguise net so he can look through this podcast through a scanner darkly. Angus, or he's got a portable fusion generator. Just what you need, ready for those spring picnics. Thanks. And thank you to everyone who continues to listen to this Bobbins. I hope you get a chance to share it with other traveller fans to help them find it. Until next time, adios, amigos.